Yes, once more T.S. Eliot. I remember many years ago, I was driving along listening to Vin Scully, probably close to 40 years ago. And this was a time when when Juan Marichal, formerly of the Giants, who had been in a big fight with Johnny Roseborough and hit him with a bat, had been retired by the Giants and was trying to catch on with the Dodgers. And I'm driving along, and Vin Scully innocently says, "Well, I guess the poet said it best. April is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire. And here is Juan Marichal with a memory of past greatness and a desire to keep going on. I almost drove off the road," with a sports guy seamlessly weaving T.S. Eliot into the commentary and making me understand it or begin to understand it for the first time. Last week, I warned you that I was going to start both sermons with the same Eliot quote from The Wasteland, but it wouldn't be the same sermon, and it's not. I'm keeping that promise. I'm not going to try to explicate The Wasteland, arguably the most important poem of the 20th century and the densest, and with the great ability of making pretty bright people feel rather dense ourselves. But it deals with something important about the human condition and the mixing of memory and desire. Because while other animals are able to learn from their actions and instinctively try to create something or save something for the future, as far as we know, and our knowledge is not complete, we are the only creatures that are truly time travelers, that have this unique access to the past and are able to plan and misplan our future, that we are time travelers going back and forth with the world of our past accessible to us, rather like a DVD with random access. We're able to go back and remember. We're able to enjoy the present. We're able to project the future. I would ask you not to try to fast forward through this particular sermon, but if you do drift into the past, those are the dangers and the blessings of random access. It's important. I'm able to go back and remember things or misremember things. There are things about which I am very certain that my wife tells me I've gotten completely wrong. And being able to learn from the past, I don't debate that with her. I just say, "Yes, honey," and let her have her version of it, because I'm not lying on purpose. My memories are real to me. I know that I've often said, where is Jane? I saw Jane come in before. She's in the back. Okay, she's mentoring. I've often said that the first rule of therapy and of theology is the same. Not even God can change the past. But we can, and we do change the past. I Photoshop the past all the time. I take the warts out of my own behavior, and I may give you a couple of scars and flaws, but it's absolutely sincere. Doesn't mean that I'm right, but I'm doing a job of Photoshopping the past. I'm able to have access to people who were dear to me that are no longer on this planet, except insofar as they live in my memory and in my heart. I still have access to them as I visit time past, as I try to understand, sometimes taking away all of the flaws and remembering only the good parts, sometimes taking away the good parts and remembering only the tears and the sorrows, the rejection. I'm pretty sure I had a better time in junior high school than my memory indicates. Because all I remember of junior high school is that girl who, when I asked her to the prom, laughed at me. Now, I live for the laugh, but not that one. But I'm sure I had a better time than I remember. So sometimes I airbrush away the pain, and sometimes I airbrush away the pleasure. It's not objective, but these are lands where we visit and where we try to learn, because the past informs the present, and then we try to create a future using all of these things. This is one of the reasons why in time travel, movies, and fiction, they're always dialing in the wrong era. They're missing by thousands of years or eons what they're aiming for, because memory is imperfect and our projections are imperfect. We have to plan for the future. It's absolutely necessary. We have to try to extrapolate from the present and see where we're going to go, but life is an incomplete information problem, as they say in detective fiction. We don't know where we're going to go. I have wonderful plans for when I win the lottery. Now, the fact that I don't buy a ticket does not, in fact, meaningfully change my odds. I don't really understand the math on this, but 0 and 1 in 100 million really come down to almost the same thing. I know there's another way of dealing with that, but it's really virtually the same thing. I try to plan a future using my past, using the present as I subjectively observe it. That's what we human beings do. We have to try to extrapolate, to be part of something that reflects part of our will and of our values. We work very hard to try to do this, and often we're surprised because the future is not completely amenable to our fantasies or to our plans. We know that it will throw curves at us. And it must, because our future is not written. We write it ourselves. We look at the future in the present. We don't know what it's going to look like, but we try to make plans. I know, man plans and God laughs, but we have to try anyway. And we don't know what's going to happen. But what we cannot do, what we must not do, is become mere spectators and believe that the future is written and predetermined and the world is too large to be amenable to our values, our choices, and our actions. We move into the future not as spectators. That would be a tragedy. We are the authors of the future. We are the actors of the future. We build the sets. We set the scenes. And with our money, we become the producers also of the future. It doesn't mean we're in total control, but it means we are not simple spectators. We are charged to try to make a difference. And here are those odds of the lottery. This is where you give up the odds. When you look at the world and say, it's just too big. It's just too complicated. We can't possibly make a difference. Then you look at history. And you look at Rosa Parks sitting down and simply by sitting, beginning the end of an edifice of cruelty. It could not be predicted or calculated that one individual would do that. When we look at the Arab Spring and the young Tunisian who burned himself to death, that there would be an Arab Spring may have been inevitable, but that one individual's life and despair and death created all of the consequences for good or evil, and it's too early to know the ultimate result, could not have been calculated. That one person does, what one person risks, what one person commits to in trying to make their values flesh and animate that flesh with passion and with commitment. It's remarkable. We can never know the effect that we have on one another. When I review my own life, again, subjectively, there are all of these people who made such an incredible difference in how my life has gone. Obviously, my parents, who brought me into this world, I was going to say kicking and screaming, but my mother did say, you know, Jonathan was just a wonderful baby. Never a problem. Never any source of worry. And then he was born. Anyway, that is her line. But she gave me this love of politics. My father gave me this love of people and of humor. My great aunt gave me the passion for literature. I had wonderful teachers who touched me and influenced me, and they never knew it at the time. They were doing their jobs, and through acts of kindness and patience have made all the difference. I look at Mort Saul, who is responsible, for good or evil, for my sense of humor. He was my model. I look over here in the front row at my friend Dr. Al Danzig, who I knew before he was a doctor, and he has been the single most influential person in my professional career. He kidnapped me from Northern California and brought me to Southern California, helped get me in my first church down here, Studio City, and here is one of the people who's one of the most important people in my life. I don't think he had any conscious knowledge of that when he's been doing all of these things. But this is who and how we are to each other. We don't know the role that we play in creating a future for all whom we see, all whom we touch, and all whom we ignore and turn away from. We are powerful authors and actors and directors and producers of a future. We take the past, we take the present, and we commit to a future. In Proverbs, it says that without a vision, the people perish. We have a vision here. We have a bright vision of where we want to go as a congregation. I hope as individuals we have visions of where we want to go as human beings, how we want to touch and change and affect the world. The future will be written by the people who care about it. It doesn't mean that we have absolute control. It means that we have the responsibility to believe that we are powerful and that our lives make a difference to each other and to this world. The future that we see for each other, that we vision and envision for this community, is not a delusion and it's not an hallucination and it is not written. It is a vision, which we make flesh by commitment, which we give life by our passionate commitment, which we animate by our continuing desire to work together, to create together, to love together, to make this community, our lives, this world, the larger world, a place of greater warmth, of greater commitment, of greater love. We do not live alone. Meaning is not just handed in whole cloth in one size fits all. We work together, we struggle together, we sometimes trip and fall together, and we are responsible for reaching out and helping each other up. Because ours is a faith that is not simply about belief. It is a faith that is put into action when we take our values and put them into action. And we have to do it with humility, because there it is not written that what I see and what I want for the future is perfect. I can be wrong. Again, going back to my wife, I'm frequently wrong about lots of things, but that's why we stay open to one another, to hear from one another, to get feedback from one another, to know that ultimately when our ears and eyes and hearts are open to one another, it helps focus our energy so that we might be creative. All of us wander, all of us stumble. It's true of every person. It's true of every community. It's true of every nation. And yet we find the good, the nourishing, and we celebrate it. And we try to multiply it like fishes and loaves and make it enough to feed and give real food and spiritual nourishment to each other as we engage this world with passion and with humility. Those are so hard to balance. It's not a no-brainer in any sense. They're hard to balance, but balance is movement. It isn't stasis. We are not frozen in time by a frightening future. We are maintaining balance, helping one another to help one another. That's the great work of life. Closing with another Eliot quote from a different poem, The Four Quartets. Time past, time present, both perhaps together in time future. We look back in reverie. We look back creatively. We extract from the past nourishment to make choices in the present, to take steps together into a future that is uncertain but can be better beyond our dreams when we work, when we love together.